And joining me now in the studio with a Trails Report, Charlie Sturgis from Mountain Trails. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what have we got going on?
looks like a beautiful weekend. Crazy. It's absolutely gorgeous out these cool mornings. First thing, Round Valley Rambler. This is the first year of our Round Valley Rambler. It's going to be out in Round Valley, obviously, and of course that means there will be some high trail use early in the morning. So 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock. This race starts over in the trailside area at the new trailhead. The majority of the race should be finished by 10 o'clock. Runners will be probably lingering until 11-ish. So if you haven't registered and you want to, you still can. We'll be out at the Park City Running Company this afternoon taking registrations. And, of course, you can register first thing in the morning, which is like 6:30 in the morning. So easier to do it today than register tomorrow. Please join us if you can. Let's see. Other things. PCMR, Park City Mountain Resort, has a event going on over there that involves about 400-some-odd kids this weekend. Sounds like a great event, but it will be utilizing a lot of the lower trail areas. Rick will be putting out a text alert. So if you're not on our text alert program, this type of information can be really handy to you. And we only send it out when there's things that are significant at any given moment. So we'll be sending out an alert today regarding the details on the PCMR event. Most everything is open, dry. Actually, the conditions are spectacular out there. A lot of dust got knocked back down after this last little snow and rain episode we had, which was great. But the pine cone crest areas, those are still probably pretty much a no-go deal. I know that I was up near the pine cone the other day, and there's definitely still a lot of trees down. So I wouldn't certainly make it an objective to go up there by any means. And for sure, that last three-quarters of a mile that's in the conifers up there is going to be pretty snow-covered. And the ridge will have some of the same conditions. So give it about another week, 10 days. You know, I usually call it July 1st. So we're closing in on that time. Otherwise, have a great weekend. It's going to be beautiful out there. And have a happy Father's Day. Oh, one last thing.
The 2017 Sundance Film Festival brought money, jobs, and tax revenues to Utah. That's according to a new study. In the studio with details on this year's economic impact report, I have Betsy Wallace. She's the CFO and Managing Director of the Sundance Institute, along with Kara Cody, Community and Government Relations Manager. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Betsy, this year's figures totals $151+ million. How does that compare with previous years?
You know, it's up. We changed firms for our analytics, and last year we reported just over $70 million. This year we're reporting $151 million. You know, we're excited about the numbers. We think that it really shows really what's been going on over the last several years. And with the new firm we've brought on, it brought in wider technologies, different kinds of technologies, newer analytics, that methodologies that could be used. And we really reached out to a broader base of attendees that came up and that were down in Salt Lake and over at the resort. So we think these numbers are more accurate as they were compared. So we're really excited about them.
Yes. I mean, that's more than doubling then.
It is. It sure is.
And what do you attribute that to?
Again, it gets back to we've been using new technologies this year. We've been using Blinksy, which is a technology that assigns an anonymous unique identifier to your phones. So as you go in and out of venues, it says, hey, yes, you've been there, and it doesn't double count you. So we've gotten a lot of accurate information out of that. We've also been able to use online surveys, inline surveys. We really just did a broader base. And this is really from Y2. We personally did not do it. The Institute didn't do it, but the firm did.
Yeah, the attendance also up some 25,000 people, 35% increase. That doesn't feel right, though, because it doesn't feel any – it doesn't feel that much busier.
Yeah, so I just get back to, I don't think, I think the numbers are right. They revalidated them left and right because it was such a big jump, absolutely. I think it's just getting back to, it's a broader, more in-depth way of counting people, and I think that they're accurate. I also want to point out that it's interesting that we saw 48% of our attendees are Utah folks, And on top of that, of the total, 45% saw their movies down in Salt Lake. So we're seeing a movement down there. So I don't want to misstate that 71,000 people are up here. That is not true. But we saw 45% down in Salt Lake, 7% over at the Sundance Resort. So it is a broad reach of the festival and being able to offer a great selection of movies throughout Utah.
So what does that mean when we talk about bringing in $151 million? That we're talking about the entire state again, not just Park
City.
That's
exactly right. So, you know, if you build it up, it starts off with the state and local taxes. It's about $14 million, and that's sales tax and everything along those lines that really go into the coffers of the state of Utah or into Park City or into Summit County. Then on the economic input or GDP, that's really the additional monies coming into the state. And surprisingly, of the $151 million, about $140 million came from people outside of the state of Utah. The biggest chunk of that is coming from lodging, from food and beverage. So it is quite a big shift, absolutely. But I do believe it gets back to, I think we're seeing true numbers.
Right. So with lodging, again, we've put that at almost $54 million. We had seen the lodging numbers drop, and we were thinking that this was attributed to then Airbnb, where we couldn't collect those numbers. So,
yeah, that's a great question. You know, this year, I didn't mean to overstep, but this year, Y2, we brought them on very early. They came in October. They started scraping data on Airbnb rates, on VRBO rates, to understand how they would shift during the festival. So we have that pre-look and during festival look. So those have been counting in those numbers. The $52 million is really broad breadth. It's Salt Lake City. It's also up here. You know, we saw ADR, or average daily rates, increase significantly up here this last year. But we did have Y2K, and Y2K wanted to do this. They went back to the Lodging Association up here and really tried to revalidate what they were seeing, and that's where those numbers came from.
Yeah. So what this shows us is that arts is an economic driver?
It sure does. And it shows that, you know, we've been here a while and we love Utah, but it is an economic driver. It's not only showing great movies to new artists, to new audiences, and everything along those lines, but the benefit from the financial side is really significant. And we're proud of that. And we hope to work forward with the state and the city to continue along those lines.
So, Kara, as the Community and Government Relations Assistant Director, that means you take these numbers and then what?
We take the show on the road. I just met with Summit County Council on Wednesday when we released the report. So presenting these facts and figures to state and local governments, as well as any civic groups that would like to have us as well. So, and just, you know, really just making that case, as Betsy stated, arts, you know, as being an economic driver, as well as support.
Yeah. I mean, is it also used then to get the restaurant and cultural grants that you receive?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, we really look forward to those. Those really help us be here and help us put on a world acclaim film festival. The tolerance of folks in the city of Utah or in the city of Park City is so appreciative. I've been here for 15 years. I know what that congestion's like. I appreciate everybody's patience as we go through it. But it is something that we're very proud of. And Kara does have her side of the business starting now. She has the outreach, community outreach going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we will kick off for summer series in a couple of weeks. But, there is kind of that other side of the coin just really the arts and culture. Like, there's this international spotlight that is on, you know, our little town every single year, and just, you know, really, just helps bring recognition to not only Park City, Summit County, but to the state of Utah as well. And we're extremely proud of that. And also then the programs that we can offer local residents as well as local students.
Yeah. Let's talk really briefly about that, because that was something that the study also analyzed, was the amount of free publicity that you receive. Some nearly $91 million. And how does that base? What is that based on?
That is the media value. So if you would take all of those blog posts, articles, news stories, anything that has, Park City, Utah in the byline, if you would add up what that would cost if we tried to, purchase that, it's over $90 million.
Yeah. And in years past, Betsy, you had been using the University of Utah Business School to do this study. Should we dismiss then what they found, or do we just are you going to stick with this Y2?
Yeah, I don't think you dismiss. I think that Y2 just right now for us just brought in a broader technology, new methodologies. And I think from going forward, we really want to see if these numbers repeat. We asked them to be very conservative in their count, and we asked them to revalidate. It took them an extra almost 2 months to do that because they wanted to make sure. They looked at talking to the Lodging Association. They looked a variety of different ways to recalculate those numbers, and they came right back on target. So I think that's where we are. It wasn't planned that when we moved to Y2 that this would happen, but it is, we believe, really accurate. It is how it feels, you know, that it is congested, not only up here, but down in Salt Lake to an extent. But we are seeing a migration of people down to Salt Lake that helps the traffic up here, and I think we look forward to try to figure out how to make that even an easier process up here.
Okay, well, I've got you here, Sarah.
That's okay.
Kara, let's talk a little bit about the summer programming. We've got screenings kicking off at City Park and then Red Butte soon?
Our first screening will be July 5th, and that will be at Red Butte Garden Amphitheater, and we're kicking off with Napoleon Dynamite. It's kind of a celebration of all things Napoleon. And then on July 7th, so Friday evening, we'll kick off the series here in Park City. We're collaborating with Park City Recreation and showing the classic documentary Riding Giants about big wave surfing, and we're working with Park City Rec on some fun enhancements surrounding that film. So we hope that residents will come out and enjoy some great Sundance films under the stars with us.
Okay. You got the lineup online as well.
Yes, correct. Sundance.org/Utah.
Okay. Anything else, Betsy, you wanted to mention?
No. Again, we just are really proud of the festival and what it's accomplished, and we are so thankful to have Utah as our home and Park City as our home, and we look forward to a great 2018 festival.
Okay. Betsy Wallace and Kara Cota, thanks for your time. KPCW News Time now, 8:23. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, last night, the Park City Council officially closed on the $38 million deal to purchase Bonanza Flat, $13 million more than city residents approved in last November's bond election. In the studio with details on how it all came together and what we can expect our tax bills to look like in November, City Council member Andy Bierman, along with Wendy Fisher from Utah Open Lands and Cheryl Fox of Summit Land Conservancy. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning.
So we did it.
Woohoo!
We did it!
Woo!
Last week, and I don't know who's got the numbers, but last week we were more than $4 million down. This week it's covered. So what happened?
We raised a lot of money in that short amount of time. Well, there were a couple of things that came together that really were amazing and significant, and it just goes to show you how important it is to have all of these different partners involved. I think, first of all, the city, and Andy can speak to this, got an excellent bond rating, and that allowed them to be able to put $2 million of bond premium into the actual purchase. Then on top of that, we had a good day at Salt Lake County. And that was nail-biting, I can tell you. I was there. There was a lot of discussion back and forth. But at the end of the day, Councilman Max Burdick, who represents the Sandy area, recognized how important this is from a watershed perspective. And he spoke to that and made some great comments along those lines. And then we were basically about $500,000 away. And it was lots of different calls out to different individuals and foundations, and I know that Cheryl received some great contributions towards the end. And then, as we announced last night, literally at 2 o'clock yesterday, I received a letter from the George S. and Dolores Dory Eccles Foundation, bringing in the final $165,000.
Sounds like KPCW way back when Nick Benami stepped up the last little bit. So, what did Salt Lake County finally contribute?
They put in $1.5 million.
Yeah. So of the $13 million, I mean, how much does the city actually have on hand?
That's a great question and one I can't completely answer. I would say at least two-thirds of it, and most of it that we don't have in hand will be trickling in before the end of the month. But there are some installment payments. There are a few grants we're waiting on that I believe Summit Lands and Utah Open Lands acquired, and those will take a couple of months to come in. And then Summit County, their grant is coming in four different parts, and we only get the first $500,000 this year. So today we're floating quite a bit, but I think most of that will come in over the summer, and the remainder of it will come in over the next couple of years.
All right. So in the meantime, we just pull that out of contingency? I mean, do we have that?
Yeah, luckily we have a very large capital projects budget that it's always revolving. There are street projects that come and go. For example, one of our major street projects this summer bid excessively high, so we had to cancel it. So that's money that's sitting in that fund that won't be used yet, and we can use those things for float.
Okay. And then in terms of how much you raised out here locally, and I don't know, I mean, do you guys, there's some separation. You were looking more statewide, you were looking more within the region,
well,
Cheryl?
You know, I think it really was a collective effort among all the nonprofits, and I think there was a lot of sharing back and forth. And I'm sure there are people who donated to, you know, Summit Land Conservancy, Mountain Trails, Utah Open Lands, Wasatch Backcountry Alliance, depending on who had a matching grant or who had a fun event, or, you know, and people participated in the leadership auction. So, you know, the Summit Land Conservancy at the end of the day took in about $585,000 in contributions towards this. And, you know, our focus really was, because we're not statewide, we really are only here in the Park City area, was really on individual contributions. So all of that is from individual contributions, which is pretty astounding and very exciting and humbling. But also we recognize that really was a collective effort. So, you know, people really came out and made contributions to all the nonprofits, and it was really fun and wonderful to be a part of that.
Okay.
Leslie, can I just add to that a little bit? This whole effort has been nothing short of amazing. Mm-hmm. 6 months ago, the city council and the mayor had a very difficult decision in that we had run a bond to raise $25 million for this. It's something we knew the community wanted, but we had a very short window to decide, could we come up and fill a $13 million gap? That price tag was staggering to us. And We had no idea how we were going to do it, but we knew we had to do it. So we moved forward with faith that this area was important to the entire region and that everyone would step up, but it was daunting. So I am just blown away how successful our coalition has been at raising a private fundraising, as well as putting leverage on all the institutional groups that contributed to this.
All right, so we've got an hour-long celebration, 3 to 4 p.m. Not a lot of parking, so people maybe want to think about taking the bus and walking up. What's going to happen? Just lots of speeches?
I think it's going to be a victory lap.
Spontaneous dancing.
Yes. I think there's even going to be some singing that takes place. I want to make That's one right. comment about the fundraising, because I know when we started this process, I too felt it was a daunting challenge, and I've just written one of the bigger checks I think I've ever written in 27 years to Park City. Here's the thing that I thought was really amazing. At the end of the day, we had looked at the private fundraising, raising $3 million, and then the public fundraising, raising the rest. We actually didn't quite get all of the way there with the public monies, but we did raise over, and I'm not going to tell the number until we get there today, but we did raise over $3 million from private fundraising sources. And I think that is just outstanding. And it was collective, and it was region-wide, and it really shows what we can do when we come together.
So what happens? I mean, we're free to go use the property as we want? Can we go camping?
Well, I think for today, it's status quo. What's restricted remains restricted, and what's allowed remains allowed up there. We have some money in reserve to do some pretty quick trailhead enhancements, put in some bathrooms, consolidate trails, signage. But it's going to have to go through a values assessment, conservation values assessment, before we put an easement on it. And so I think tomorrow it's going to look very much like today. But eventually we're going to do what we need to do to keep that – keep that land healthy and vital. And that's going to be a long public process to discuss all those uses, what they'll look like, and how it's treated. But it'll remain open and wild and available for recreation.
And so when we talk about the putting the easement on it, Wendy, your group's going to do that?
Yeah, we are going to hold the conservation easement. But the great thing here is we have a tremendous wealth of expertise within the coalition. And so we're going to be utilizing them to help us as we move forward with the resource inventory and analysis of the property and involve a lot of the different stakeholders. As we know, a lot of people came to the table because this was watershed land, and that's something we're going to be looking at. There's also a sensitive species on the property that we're already aware of. So there's a lot of investigation on the property that needs to take place to ensure, as Andy said, we are looking at a forever deal here. So what took us 6 months to do is going to take us forever to continue to protect.
Yeah. How long does that investigation take? I mean, will it be done next year?
Yeah, we anticipate that we'll work through this through the summer and the fall, and then probably sometime in the winter we'll kind of put the final touches on the conservation easement.
All right. And what we know is that it will remain as seasonal access then for now.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think there's any interest in opening up that road year-round.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything else you all want
thank
to say
you.
About that? Okay.
Huge thank you.
Huge thank you to the community.
Huge
absolutely.
Thank you to the community. Absolutely.
Okay. We'll see you later this afternoon. Andy, let's continue with you. Talking a little bit about earlier this week in a split vote, the Summit County Council narrowly approved the $100,000 payment to Mountain Accord Central Wasatch Commission. What we're hearing now is that what we're getting for that $100,000, the county council also having to consider raising taxes, and that this $100,000 doesn't even get us a seat at the table. But you feel a little bit differently about
that.
Yeah,
I think there's once again, a lot of misinformation running around about the Mountain Accord, which is now morphing into the Central Wasatch Commission. And I find it really ironic that we had this amazing regional effort. And I heard the question yesterday, what do we gain from having these relationships with the Wasatch Front? If I had to put a price tag on that today, I'd say about $7 million of the dollars going towards Bonanza Flat came from relationships that we built during the Accord process and people that have shared values on protecting the Wasatch Mountains. So that's really the obvious thing that comes to mind. As far as Summit County needing to raise their taxes for that $100,000, I think that would be an overstatement. Certainly they have many things that they need to spend money on and diverse needs, and they have to assess what the key ones are. But I think we've gotten a lot of value out of the Accord process. Right now there's a study going on for I-80, about a $400,000 study. Looking at transportation needs, and that's being led by Summit County. So I think it's addressing things they would have to study otherwise. And thus far, I think they've only contributed $50,000 to the Accord process. The city's put in $100,000. So we're coming out ahead on that. And as you'd, if I can expand a little bit, you'd ask about the board seat there. And we will be represented. They are forming a commission, and they have asked for one representative from the Wasatch back. That is an appointed seat as opposed to the core five founding members on this or four founding members. But it is actually part of the ILA document. It is required, and it is a full seat with full voting power and representation, and they very much wanted us on that commission.
All right. In other business, the city council discussed the 19 affordable units coming up at the 1450 16 Park Avenue, as well as the Central Park condominiums along the rail trail, where it looks like all work has stopped there. Do you know what's going on?
I don't. My understanding is we're still on schedule, and you know, maybe they're held up waiting on subs. It's certainly a busy crunch time of year.
Yeah. The part of that conversation was about who should get preferential treatment. And so at this point, are we reserving some space for seniors?
No, it's going to be yes and no. It's going to be a lottery process, but we are setting aside two units that seniors get preference on. If they meet the other criteria, they will have preference, as well as we're setting aside four units for essential service workers, which are teachers, fire, police, city or county employees.
All right. So there was you had said that you wanted to help out seniors who are looking to downsize, but it's hard for them under the affordable regulations because of the property that they're owning. So, I mean, I guess I'm just curious. That doesn't sound like what we're trying to do here. I mean, if people with money want to downsize, they can downsize. They certainly don't need to be part of an affordable project.
Well, the challenge, I mean, there are multiple things we're trying to accomplish with our affordable housing program. One of them is certainly providing something affordable for our workforce, but we're also trying to use it for community building. We're trying to keep our community diverse, and that means having our seniors in the community, keeping different age or ethnic groups here and different professions. And we've heard a lot of feedback from the seniors that it's very difficult for them because they want to downsize, and you know, all their money, their retirement essentially, is in their house. And if they sell that house, they have a large nut, but that's what they need to live off of. And so having that money in the bank, they don't qualify for the senior housing. They exceed the asset test and the income cap. So we are, we're just trying to see, is there a way that we can provide some senior housing that's fair and fits into our program? And what I had suggested is we allow the seniors to pay retail value, but live in these spaces. And these spaces are going to be affordable just because of their size. It's really hard to find a 1,200 square foot house in Park City. Most of them are 3,000 square feet. So it'd be less expensive. It would be ADA accessible. And council's still grappling with that. I think there was sympathy for that, but we felt like priority needs to go to those that can't afford other options. So we're going to keep working on it.
And in terms of the kind of the essential employees, I mean, would they lose their residence if, in fact, they took a job in Salt Lake then?
That's another issue we haven't entirely sorted through. I think council is mixed on that. It on paper, yeah, it seems like if we're going to subsidize somebody's housing, they ought to live and work in Park City. But I have a really hard time. There are people that may have lived and worked here for a decade and are integral parts of the community, and they lose their job or they need to make more wages and they start driving to Salt Lake. I don't think that makes them any less of a community member. They can still contribute in many ways. Their kids are likely still in the schools. They can volunteer for our boards. So I'm not sure the solution is to kick them out of their house. So we're going to think about that once more and see if there's a way we can keep the programs fair. You're always working around people. I think there are a few individuals that try to game the program, and they kind of leave a bad taste for everybody else. So every year we refine our deed restrictions and how we approach these, trying to take out those exceptions.
The fee waiver for Peace House had an interesting outcome. The Peace House asking for a waiver of nearly $200,000, and this was what, in building fees?
It was all kinds of building and inspection fees, impact fees. And council has been struggling with this idea of impact fees, waiving impact fees to nonprofits and deserving groups. And the reason why is because it adds up to millions of dollars if we're not careful. We've got a lot of nonprofits in town that are doing great things. And we're essentially repurposing taxpayer money that would go towards other community benefit. And so we've tried to put some caps on that. We've tried to come up with an evaluation system. But in a case of something like the Peace House, it's really, really hard because they provide a safety net that is literally life and death for our community that doesn't otherwise exist. So we want to support them to the best of our ability. And we've done that in multiple ways for this move. And last night we reached a nice compromise where we offered them half of that fee waiver at $100,000.
All right. And that was based that the Peace House and the city would partner then on several activities? What would those be?
Yeah, and that wasn't overly defined. We already partner on those activities, so I think it was more highlighting that we will continue our work together in the schools and with our victim advocate program.
In supporting that waiver, you told a story about what a friend with another nonprofit had said to you. What was that?
Yeah. Well, I was struggling because I feel like we need to treat our nonprofits consistently and fairly. And if we do something for one, we should probably do it for the others. And so I'm looking at the size of this contribution thinking there's no way we can subsidize all of our nonprofits to this degree. So I asked my friend that's an ED of an organization, you know, how do you feel about this? And he said, Andy, this is a life and death issue. What we do is we provide things that encourage fun and public health, but this is something that is essential to the community and you should support them. And right there, that helped me make up my mind.
All right. And did you go ahead and then approve a final budget, or does that come back?
No, we approved our budget. We amended our 2017 budget, which we're required to do to reflect the actuals, and we approved our 2018 budget. So it's nice to be through that process.
So no tax increases, but there were several fee waivers, including like a 6% increase on our water rates.
Yep, water will continue to rise as we're trying to come into compliance with our state and EPA requirements. And we're going to see some small increases in building fees, rec fees, but no tax increases.
Okay. Anything else?
I just want to remind everybody that there are two celebrations today on the Bob Wells Plaza right outside here. The first one is KPCW. We will be saying goodbye to your general manager, Larry Warren, and welcoming Renee Bodley. And then at 3 o'clock, we are going to have the Bonanza Flat celebration. I hope the community will come out for both.
Okay. Andy, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's 8:45 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, last week, the Park City Council postponed making a decision on a $268,000 contractor with Downtowner to provide free on-demand rides as a way to get people out of their cars and to take public transportation. That happened after local transportation drivers asked them to reconsider that decision. Joining me now in the studio with an update, I have Mike Phelps with Karaoke Cabs and Jack Fenton with Ski Town Express and Park City Bike Shuttle. Good morning to both of you guys.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's just back up a little bit, Jack, and have you talk a little bit about your concern as representing the Park City ground transportation crews.
Well, I'm looking at this from a businessman's perspective, and the city is looking to spend $360,000 to provide rides from point to point. A point-to-point ride is where somebody makes a call in one manner or another. They request a vehicle to come get them. The vehicle runs up to the area, grabs that person, and takes them to the River Horse for dinner. $360,000 to provide that. That is already covered. We have, in fact, that market is saturated. If you were to go to a bank with a proposal, and you had this as a business plan, you wanted to spend $360,000 to provide free taxi rides to the affluent, the bank, the loan officer would tell you not even to fill out the paperwork. It makes no sense whatsoever.
But what changed, though? Because this was not, originally, it was not touted as a point-to-point program. It was the last mile, as we kind of heard it called. It was to get the person who wasn't close to a bus stop to the closest bus stop.
Well, I don't know when it changed, but it did change, in fact. It did become a point-to-point service. It evolved somehow. And that's the nature of these programs. Once they get rolling, they tend to evolve. And it evolved into an area that's saturated. It's highly covered. We don't need to spend tax dollars doing this.
So you were most concerned with, hey, what about us? And at least it gave the council pause to...
Absolutely. The council is competing in the private sector. If they're willing to compete in the private sector in the taxi industry, what sector is next? Are they going to go after the pizza business? Are they going to go after the electric bike business? A city's basic job at its most basic level is to provide protection, police protection, fire protection, roads, water, things of that nature. They have no business being in any business that's already provided by the private sector.
So if the whole premise of this was to get people out of their cars onto public transportation, we really haven't done that because now we have the car traveling twice as much as it needs to.
Absolutely correct, Leslie. It doubles the traffic in any given neighborhood. Rather than a person jumping in their car, running their errand, and bringing the car back, now that car travels twice. It goes in once to pick up that passenger. It leaves the house. It does the errand. It returns, and then it leaves the house a second time. That's four cars going by a given point.
Yeah.
Doubled the traffic.
And I think that was something that the mayor, at least, Mike, talked about at the meeting last week.
Yeah, we talked about a great many things at the meeting, and that was one of them. Part of our reason for being at the meeting was to voice our opinions in opposition, but also to let the city know that we would like to work with them in forming a solution. We all agree that traffic and parking is a challenge in Park City. So what we have been proposing and talking to the city about is a partnership where the local businesses, the local transportation providers can partner with the city, provide the types of services that the city feels can help alleviate this, and where it's a win situation for everyone. It will avoid the traffic mitigation issues by hopefully getting people to use this type of transportation and avoid parking issues as well. Looking at what's happened with this program in other cities, and I've personally spoken to folks in other cities, both as passengers and commercial taxi businesses, it has put the taxi businesses out of business. Wherever this program has gone, the taxi businesses are done as well. So it is in direct competition, and that may not have been the city's intention in the beginning, but but that is the outcome.
Yeah. So there was no discussion with local taxi companies until you guys showed up at the meeting?
To the best of our understanding, one large transportation company was approached with this. That transportation company, as we know, is now filed for bankruptcy protection. But none of the other local transportation companies were approached, at least none to our knowledge whatsoever.
So they agreed to at least meet with you, and that happened this week. What happened?
We had a great meeting with them on Monday. We were able to present a couple different ideas of how to partner with this city and then demonstrate through technology how it would actually work. I think the representatives from the city were really quite surprised with what we really could do, not just talking about it, but actually demonstrating to them. Since Monday, we have reached out to them again to show them again a couple different ways we can go about this. So far, they've seemed receptive. This will come up for a vote in 2 weeks, and we hope that the general public becomes more aware of this because I echo Jack's sentiments that fiscally this makes no sense. It's a very expensive process to transport people. If we partner with this city, we can do it for a more affordable, as I say, cheaper, better, faster than the type of system they're looking to do right now. And that's based on the numbers that are happening in other cities.
So you'll all get paid and people will still get free rides from the store or from their house to the store and back?
Well, what we envision is going back to the original plan, and that's that last mile, first mile, where the folks that really are in an underserved area and can't get to public transportation, we can get them to public transportation, and then they can get on the bus or whatever it may be, and then to their final destination. If the folks wanted to have a point-to-point, then that would be a regular taxi ride, and they would have to pay for it. Personally, I see no reason, and agree with Jack, why the city should pay for real taxi service for the general public. Public transportation, yes. Private taxi service, no.
So tell me a little bit more about the technology. I mean, it works. I mean, it's ready to go.
There are a couple different companies we've reached out to. The largest of which does business in 50 countries. They're providing over 500 different type of mobile and desktop apps. They work with transportation companies literally all over the world. And what we could do is pull from all their technology and past experience and create an app that would really be unlike any other in the world.
So how is it just for your company? Or, I mean,
no.
Now you're all, you guys are
all
one company?
Yeah, yes, all of the independents would be on this app.
It would be a collective of what we envision of anyone that is a licensed transportation company with Park City in good standing could participate in this program and be able to transport those people. So it would be equal, shared, no preference whatsoever.
So do we get to drive in beat-up minivans, or are we going to drive in Teslas?
Whoa. Really, Leslie?
I don't think any of us yet have a Tesla, but again, all the vehicles in town have to pass certain safety standards and so forth. And I can speak for myself and Jack and several of the companies that I'm very familiar with, and they're all nice vehicles.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have an issue with is the Teslas. This proposal, part of it was that they wanted electric vehicles, and I think that's great. But they also wanted four-wheel drive. Why do they need an all-wheel drive electric vehicle if this is a six-month pilot program that's only going to last through the summer? So that tells me that they plan on expanding this into the winter months. If they expand this into the winter months, now we're looking at $750,000 to give people free rides to Main Street. Do the taxpayers of Park City want to spend $750,000 to give people free rides? I don't think that's where our money should be spent. The other thing that concerns me is it seems like the city's mantra has evolved a little bit. In recent years, we've spent millions and millions of dollars on bike paths. We've spent money on tunnels, signage. We've spent, I don't know what the dollar amount is, but it's in the millions to make this a walkable community. That was our goal. And now instead of being a walkable community, you're telling me that somebody can't walk three blocks through Prospector to get to the bus stop? That's insane. The buses cover Prospector quite nicely. It's a flat neighborhood. The one neighborhood that isn't covered in this proposal is the Aerie. Now, the Aerie is a neighborhood of $3 and $4 million homes. It's primarily second homes. So again, are we trying to get the affluent out of their Range Rovers and into our Teslas? Is that the goal here? What is the goal, and when will we know the goal has been met? I don't think the city really has a metric for whether this program is actually doing what it's intended to do.
My understanding that Park Meadows was also not included.
Park Meadows is not included. More neighborhoods are not included than are included. Lower Deer Valley is not included. Upper Deer Valley is not included. So now you're going to have the billionaires in Bald Eagle. They're going to feel slighted that the millionaires in the area are getting a free ride, and they're not. And so the whole program is poorly planned in my point of view.
One thing I might add, Leslie, is one of the members of the transportation community has sent out an informal survey over the last few days via social media. I believe the latest number is approaching 300 responses, and I can tell you, based on those numbers, overwhelmingly negative response to this proposal via that informal survey.
All right, so we should see you guys back in a couple of weeks then?
Yes. One point I'd like to make before we part ways here, Leslie, is under this proposal, the drivers are going to be paid $15 an hour. $15 an hour, if you're driving full-time, that's $30,000 a year that this driver is going to take home as a full-time employee. They will get no benefits with that. This is not a city employee. This is paid for by the Downtowner app company.
Well, Peace House invites the community to its celebration as it stakes the footprint of the new Peace House Community Campus on Tuesday in the studio. With details, I have Facility Project Director Jane Patton and Development Director Liza Springmeyer. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Jane, the celebration taking place when and where on Tuesday?
It's at our new property where we're building the facility, and that is at 700 Round Valley Drive. It's right next to the People's Health Clinic and Health Department.
Okay, and that's happening when?
It's happening next Tuesday, the 20th, at 11 o'clock.
All right, so are you ready to start building, or are we just laying out the stakes at this point?
We're starting slowly. We're still working on our building permit, but we do have the permits to begin excavation. So that's what we're doing.
All right, so when will it be built?
We hope that it's going to be completed. Our goal is September of 2018.
All right, and how much is it going to cost?
Well, we want to save that as part of our celebration event on Tuesday. So stay tuned, and I hope you will join us as we celebrate the progress we've already made and ask the community to help us reach our goals.
So you've already kicked off the capital campaign, Liza?
Mm-hmm. So this will be the official public announcement of our capital campaign, and we're grateful to the supporters that have gotten us to this point and laid the foundation of support needed to start the public phase.
All right. Got a ways to go, though?
Yeah. We've got significant support still needed.
And once completed, Jane, what is it going to include?
It's going to include a continuation of emergency shelter services. We'll have 8 units of emergency shelter, 12 units of transitional housing. And what's really exciting is all the support services will be there for use of those that are in residence as well as the rest of the community, including case management, therapy for adults and children, support groups, meetings and trainings. So it will be really a resource center for the community.
Okay. Any news on a permanent executive director?
Yes, that announcement's coming soon also. She begins the first week in July.